Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are speaking with two doctors who are calling for universal health care. The United States is the only large, high-income nation that does not provide universal coverage to its citizens. We'll also discuss the high costs of relying on a for-profit system, the end of expanded COVID benefits, Republican-controlled states that still refuse to expand Medicaid, the epidemic of gun violence in the U.S., the health worker crisis, and more. Thousands of doctors have left the workforce, leaving many hospitals and clinics struggling. One in five doctors say they plan to leave their practice in the coming years, according to studies published in JAMA. So what will it take to make universal health care and a robust social safety net a priority? And how will that affect health care workers? Dr. Susan Rogers is president of Physicians for a National Health Program, an organization advocating for a universal, comprehensive, single-payer national health program with more than 20,000 members and chapters across the country. Dr. Susan Rogers is recently retired from Stroger Hospital of Cook County, Illinois, and continues to volunteer as an attending internist. Dr. Rogers is assistant professor of medicine at Rush University, where she's an active member of the Committee of Admissions. Hi, Dr. Rogers. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you. Dr. Eric Reinhardt is an anthropologist of policing, prisons, and public health, and a resident psychiatry resident at the Physician Scientist Training Program at Northwestern University's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. Dr. Eric Reinhardt's work has appeared in a number of medical and legal journals and media outlets like The Nation and USA Today. Dr. Reinhardt's latest piece in the New York Times from February 5th is titled, "Doctors Are Not Burned Out from Overwork, We're Demoralized by Our Health System." Hi, Dr. Reinhardt. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, I want to start off by asking you both about the epidemic of gun violence in this country. It is just so horrific across the board, but to hear the doctors talk about what they are seeing night after night, day after day. On Monday, a 25-year-old man opened fire at a bank in downtown Louisville, Kentucky, killing five people. Officials said he used an AR-15-style rifle in the shooting, which he legally bought at a local dealership last week. Officials there said 40 people have already died from gun violence just in Louisville. One person was killed in a separate shooting several blocks from the bank. I just want to play a clip from Dr. Jason Smith, the chief medical officer at the University of Louisville Health.
Caring for three shooting victims, plus the other that came in, is not an unfrequent day for us. And the events surrounding this made this obviously much more difficult. But to be honest with you, we barely had to adjust our operating room schedule to be able to do this. That's how frequent we are having to deal with gun violence in our community. I'll tell you personally, I'm weary. I've been in Louisville for 15 years, all of it at University Hospital. For 15 years, I've cared for victims of violence and gunshot wounds. And people say I'm tired, but I'll be answered. It's more than tired. I'm weary. There's only so many times you can walk into a room and tell someone they're not coming home tomorrow. And it just breaks your heart. When you hear someone screaming, "Mommy," or "Daddy," it just becomes too hard day in and day out to be able to do that. Now, my team is fantastic. They're absolute professionals and they're wonderful. But sooner or later, it catches up to everybody. You just can't keep doing what we're doing because you just can't keep seeing these lives lost. You can't keep seeing all the people with these horrific injuries coming through the door without doing something to try and help them. And I don't know what the answers are. I'm a doctor. I don't know what the answers are. But to everyone who helps make policy, both at state, city, federal, I would simply ask you to do something. Because doing nothing, which is what we've been doing, is not working. We have to do something. Because this is just getting out of hand across our city and across this great nation of ours.
That is Dr. Jason Smith, the chief medical officer at the University of Louisville Health. Last week, we had two doctors on the show who were on the front lines of gun violence. Dr. Bindi Nayak-Mathuria, chief of pediatric surgery at the University of Texas, said her colleagues treat gun violence victims every single night. Dr. Rogers, I just wanted to bring this up because doctors, your colleagues, are on the front lines of this on a regular basis. What are your thoughts about the epidemic of gun violence in this country, and what are you hearing from your colleagues?
You know, it's really a horrific problem, and I think it, you know, is a symptom of how so many people are just lost in this country. I know working at Stroger Hospital, we had a large trauma unit, and I would often have to see patients there. And personally, it had the same effect on me of just being overwhelmed, feeling, you know, unable to do anything about it. And I think it's almost a reflection of how people, I'm not a psychiatrist. Dr. Reinhart can probably address this better than I can, but it's almost as if people are left with no choices. And this is how they resolve their internal issues, is by this behavior. And what we need to do is get the guns out of their hands and then address that behavior in another way. And we just refuse to do this. And this country, you know, treating people who choose, we decide not to treat people who choose to resolve their issues with violence, just like we choose to not treat so many other people with issues that the healthcare field can help. And it's just an abandonment of our feeling as a society.
Dr. Reinhart, what would you add?
Yeah, I would echo what Dr. Rogers just said. We have a massive problem in terms of how we conceptualize safety, violence, care in this country. The way that we conceptualize it is on very individual terms. So historically, when people talk about violence interruption programs or public safety programs, they're talking about policing, or maybe they're talking about individual level interventions, maybe getting somebody into therapy, these kinds of things. These things are not necessarily unimportant, therapy, for example. But we have to start regarding this as a collective.
Oh, did we lose Dr. Reinhart?
Our communities and neighborhoods.
Dr. Reinhart, sorry, we lost you there for a minute. Can you just repeat what you said?
Yeah, I was saying we need to get away from thinking about this as an individual problem. This is not just about some disturbed individual who may or may not suffer from mental illness, as we constantly hear from conservative politicians, for example, who are wrapping up violence with mental illness. Sometimes that may, in fact, be the case. But these kind of individualistic frameworks where we talk about some kind of character pathology or moral pathology, they detract from the collective responsibility we have to address these problems via policies. Violence in places like where I live in Chicago is a symptom of decades of concentrated disinvestment from communities. And I think, like Dr. Rogers was saying, what we are seeing now is symptomatic of that. And we're not going to be able to solve it as healthcare professionals through better trauma care or even through better psychiatric care. We have to think about the economic conditions and the lack of trust in communities that's well-founded. There's not a lot of good basis for trust in a lot of these violent communities right now because of this public disinvestment. So we need to reverse that. We need to build public systems of support and understand that public health approaches to violence are absolutely essential. We can't keep falling back on criminalization and policing as if this is a solution to this long brewing, long-term problem that we have brought upon ourselves as a nation.
Can you elaborate on that? Can you talk more about public health solutions to violence?
Yeah. So public health, as opposed to biomedicine, it's concerned with root causes of disease. And its primary site of intervention is through prevention. Whereas as doctors, we have patients who come to us, they're already sick in general. We're trying to respond to what has already arisen when prevention has failed. Public health backs up, says, well, what happens if we give people support a year earlier, 2 years earlier, 3 weeks earlier? Could we prevent these crises from arising? Could we prevent the disease from arising? And to do that, you think about the political determinants of health. So poverty, lack of housing, lack of social support structures, lack of access to earlier stages of preventative primary care. The same kinds of approaches are really important for violence. What we do in the U.S. is we reduce everything to a crisis, as if we kind of wipe clean the slate of history, and all we have right in front of us is this crisis moment we have to respond to. So a lot of even progressive actors right now are talking about non-police crisis response systems. This is really important. So somebody is in a psychiatric crisis or behavioral crisis, we should be able to think about responding to people without guns drawn. That often provokes more violence than is necessary. But the real issue in my mind is backing up further and saying, why did that crisis arise? We need to focus on crisis prevention systems. We need to focus on sustained, supportive, preventative care systems. That doesn't mean healthcare. It means lay infrastructures of care, housing, addiction treatment, social support, having a community health worker available in your neighborhood who can just check in on you every day when you're struggling. These are effective public health oriented violence prevention initiatives. And we need to think about dissolving the arbitrary distinction between public health and public safety, which has really served policing infrastructures. When people talk about public safety in the US, they almost are always talking about policing policy, despite the fact that decades of evidence shows that policing is not actually an effective means of violence prevention, certainly not compared to these other kinds of interventions that we could invest in, but do not.
Dr. Rogers, what would you like to add? As a doctor who advocates for universal, comprehensive, single-payer health care, there's so much. I often think about what happened under COVID, where the government showed that it can greatly expand the social safety net for people in need, given that so many people really struggle to make ends meet. I mean, we saw an expansion of food stamps, rental assistance, universal school lunches, the child tax credit, Medicaid expansion, and then it was all taken away, which is so cruel. And there's so many problems we're facing now because of what Dr. Reinhart is describing, decades of disinvestment. There's so much work to be done at this point. How are you talking about these issues now? Where can we begin so we can actually implement real solutions? We saw a lot of these solutions under COVID.
Yes, we did see some good solutions under COVID. But what COVID did was it really exposed a bigger underlying problem. And what Dr. Reinhart alluded to, that I totally agree with, that we tend to look at things individually rather than looking at the big picture. And we saw how what COVID did to communities that were disinvested, had lack of services, had lack of access to healthcare. And we can't just fix that by addressing those individual things. There's the whole picture that this country has totally ignored. We don't really have a good public health system anymore. And I think that that was really exposed with COVID. And a lot of the policies that were enacted to help address things from COVID really didn't acknowledge some of the underlying problems. Take, for example, to get vaccinated. You have a community that is very poor and you have a drive-through vaccine station and the people who live there don't have cars. So the solutions don't actually always address the problem. There's a problem with hospitals and trying to get transfer patients. And that system is totally inappropriate because patients from endowed hospitals cannot get transferred to a hospital that can provide the care they need because of the finances in there. So this whole underlying system, we have to realize that medicine, the issues with the inequities that are obvious in medical care reflect the inequities of this entire country. And the source of those inequities is the same. This country was built on inequities and they have flourished with the continuation of the root of those inequities, which is mostly racial, and that transfers into finances. And so unless we look at the big picture, I'm working in one aspect with healthcare. Dr. Reinhart is working with the prison system and violence, but there has to be an acknowledgement that all of these issues are interrelated and addressing one does not fix the others. We have to look at the root problem, and that is the social determinants of health or the political determinants of health, all of these other issues that continue to keep people disenfranchised.
Dr. Rogers, I think this is why it's so difficult to think about where we go from here, given that we are now living at a time when, in many cases, the minority is in power. When you look at Tennessee, for example, look at so many states across the country that have been gerrymandered. I mean, we can't even get universal health care passed in California because of money in politics. The Democrats, some of the Democrats tried, but they didn't have enough Democratic votes. So given the system that is in place, that is very undemocratic, where do we begin on these issues? Given that at this time, I mean, I really want to emphasize this, with people losing those expanded COVID benefits, I mean, we've got people who are skipping meals right now. We've had them on the show. It's anywhere you look, you've got, in many cases, a crisis. So where do we begin?
You know, it's a... The persons in power in this country, they, you know, have always sort of used the whole idea of personal responsibility. People have to have responsibility for themselves to address these things, which we know is clearly not true. When they talked about continuing free lunches, one of the congressmen, I'm not sure what state he was from, but he said, that's just a sign of parental negligence. We shouldn't do that. So again, it goes back to personal responsibility without the acknowledgement that some people need help. And I think that I think almost all of it goes back to the roots in this country that was built on white supremacy. And even poor white people feel that they're okay because they're not at the bottom of the totem pole, which that's where Black people are. And that's why a white majority can continue to rule and make these policies that still disenfranchise all people who are poor, regardless of their color. Look at what happened in just Tennessee. So if we don't get to the root of the racial, I'm thinking of the right word, but just the whole attitude and culture of white supremacy in this country is coming back. And I find it very, very frightening that the stories I heard from my parents is coming back to reality. And they are doing that now. And part of it is because it's born out of racism. And I think we should be clear about that. The violence spreads throughout, but the core of the problem, I think, is the racism on which this country was built and how it continues to enforce that.
Dr. Reinhart, what are your thoughts? What would you add?
I agree with Dr. Rogers that that's a root issue. My orientation, whenever I'm thinking about these things, which I face in my everyday life and have for a long time as an anthropologist and a physician in Chicago, is what can we do about it? So we know that racism is deeply embedded in American culture. But also as an anthropologist, you know, our field of study as social anthropologists is culture. And what we've seen within anthropology for a long time is the idea of culture can be used to deflect attention away from the policies that are shaping it, from the political economic conditions, from the financial structures that are shaping cultural attitudes. And that is something we can act upon, policy. It's very hard to just say we need to have a cultural transformation. What do you do about that? So I think we need to link the fact that we have a deeply white supremacist culture in the US to the policy structures that sustain and intensify that. And how do we think about reversing them? So for example, I think, as Dr. Rogers was saying, we absolutely have to think about public safety, public health, and healthcare as all expressions of the same root drivers of distress. They are all responding to the same thing. And yet when we talk about what systems we have for addressing each of these areas, they're totally disparate systems. We need to think about systematic policies that interweave all of these three domains, health, safety, healthcare. And I think a really important way to do this, to build trust, to build a culture of trust, is to give people interpersonal relationships through which they know one another and they know the state, they know the government as a supportive agency for them. What we have right now in the US is if you're in distress, you need help, There's only one agency you can call. You can call the police and you'll know that within an hour or so, they'll show up at your door, generally speaking. There's no other person you can call where you're assured to get help. Now, in the U.S., we do know, particularly if you're a Black individual, you're likely to be killed, maimed, sexually assaulted X out of, 10,000 times if you call the police. But still, that's the only person you can call. So you do that. And in fact, when you're asked, do you want more police or nothing? People will generally say, we want more police. So we need to think about building a different kind of infrastructure that responds to people's needs. In my view, the way that you could do this, having combined effects for safety, health, and healthcare, is through a large-scale community health worker system across the country. We employ people in our most dispossessed, disinvested neighborhoods with gainful employment, proper wages, not exploitative community health worker positions where you're paying them $15,000, $20,000, but $60,000, $80,000 a year with proper benefits, like we pay the police, to provide care to one another in their communities. Not healthcare necessarily, just basic supportive care. And that can be integrated with some preventative healthcare roles like diabetes management, et cetera. I think it's these kinds of concrete policies that we could build out and that it should be very clear we need after public health systems in the U.S. absolutely failed during COVID, as our public safety systems are absolutely failing. And as our healthcare system, as this site of reaction that has to respond to all of these failures that come before, is out of control. We spend nearly twice as much money per capita as the next highest spending healthcare nation in the world, and our health outcomes are abysmal. Mm-hmm. So all of our systems are reeling right now. We need to think of an integrated response that can address all of these failures and really root it in communities and in systems that build trust within those communities. So in my view, that's how I think about that. And I think that's how you produce cultural change.
Speaking of large-scale community health systems, you remind me of a piece I read in CalMatters about what you're describing, that money went to community organizations in especially rural areas of the state. And so you had community groups that were able to go door to door to talk to people about COVID, about how they're doing, what do they need, are they behind in their rent, do they need food assistance? And these community groups said they felt so empowered because they were able to create so many close relationships and do that important work, and it was very successful. But again, then the money was taken away. And so now they don't know what's going to happen to those relationships. So again, Dr. Reinhart, I mean, it's like we know the solutions, but it's there's a little teaser there, and then all of a sudden it's taken away. How do we address that?
I think what you just described is reflective of a process that we've seen over the last 40 years in the U.S., certainly since Reagan in the 80s. Which is the increasing privatization and balkanization of basic supportive services. So you said there's community-based organizations are going out and doing that. And that's the reality across the country right now. The most essential care work is done by community-based organizations. And they do great work, and they have incredible workforces and knowledge power. They're usually underfunded. The minute their grants are cut, the organization disappears, or a new initiative, no matter how successful, it disappears. The workers are often exploited. They don't have rights to unionize. They don't have benefits. Some of the work they do, like violence interrupters, for example, is incredibly dangerous, difficult work, often far more dangerous and difficult than policing work. And yet they're paid a pittance compared to police. They have no long-term security. So what do we do about that reality? In my view, we have to reverse this 40-year-long privatization agenda and start building public systems. There are a few reasons for this. One, it allows us to make more democratic demands on sustaining these systems, to not have them all scattered around the country and easy to kind of pick off one by one as the grants go away. It also provides an infrastructure for proper labor protections for the workers that we should value who do this work. Just like we value police officers, we should be and compensate them accordingly. We should value community care workers. And then last, I think this is really, really important. What we're suffering from right now in the U.S. is a massive plague of distrust. The average American right now does not trust public health. They don't trust healthcare. They don't trust doctors in many instances. They've been fleeced. They've been bankrupted many times. Healthcare bankruptcy or medical bankruptcy is a leading cause of bankruptcy in the U.S. What we lack right now is an infrastructure for building, for earning public trust. And if you do not have trust in communities, if communities do not trust that the government exists to serve them, then your safety outcomes are going to be horrific. Your health outcomes are going to be terrible. We have to build an infrastructure that earns trust, and you do that through public systems. If you are taking public money and empowering community-based organizations to do all this work in their own name, and not in the government's name. Although the work can be great and they can build important relationships, it doesn't provide a strong basis for building civic trust, public trust. So in my view, this is a really important part of things. We have to reverse this privatization trend that we've suffered from for a very long time. And that's a difficult task, but I think we have to do it.
Right. And as a result, connected to what you're saying, according to official numbers from the CDC, 6 in 10 Americans live with at least one chronic disease like heart disease and stroke, cancer, or diabetes. These are the leading causes of death in this country and the leading driver of healthcare costs. Before we go to break, Dr. Rogers, what would you like to add?
Well, just regarding healthcare, it's massively dysfunctional. And I also support, you know, single payer Medicare for all, because right now, if we have a system based on a structure of what you can afford, it will always be inequitable. And so people will not trust the system. And the lack of trust is earned. I mean, the behavior has been untrustworthy. And it'll be difficult unless, I think one of the things that needs to be done again, as Dr. Reinhart said, in the community based. But there's still, that needs to be ongoing. I know that now with what is happening in healthcare, there's no community base anymore. Hospitals are no longer community based. They are corporate institutions with the head of the institution somewhere, but all the other hospitals within that respond to whatever that dictum comes from the head, and they're not responsive to their communities anymore. They are responsive to the big pocket, to the money that comes from the institution. So the reason for lack of trust is almost well earned. And I know if you look at some of the larger institutions here, large hospitals where people come from overseas with money in hand, they provide excellent care at that hospital, but the surrounding communities are destitute, and they often have the worst health inequity numbers, the highest maternal mortality rates, the highest deaths from cardiovascular and heart disease, from diabetes and hypertension, renal failure, who live right across the street but cannot be treated at those institutions because they have Medicaid often, and that institution isn't interested in caring for that group of patients. So it's a whole societal thing. And right now, it seems that the motive of a lot of these large institutions, again, is money and power. And that drives a lot of the decisions that are made. And so I think it's just important that organizations like PNHP that I work with, there's other many, many social service advocates, organizations that promote that we have to become more empowered. We have to get people to believe in us, to support us, so that we can get the message out and try to work for these changes. And a lot of it is cultural. It isn't just, as we know, even with COVID, saying the right things doesn't necessarily make people do the right things.
Right. Oh, we're going to take a quick break. Dr. Susan Rogers is president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Eric Reinhart is a resident psychiatry at the Physician Scientist Training Program at Northwestern University's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. If you are on Medicaid or Medi-Cal in California, we have some information from you. It's really important. We're going to share this after a break. Almost 15 million people might fall off Medicaid because they no longer qualify. So we're going to give you information about how to make sure that doesn't happen to you. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with two doctors who are calling for universal health care. If you have any questions or comments for Dr. Susan Rogers and Dr. Eric Reinhart, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have been doing shows about universal health care on this show for so many years. What do you think it'll take to actually get there, but to also just completely reform the health system in this country. Dr. Susan Rogers is president of Physicians for a National Health Program and has recently retired from the Stroger Hospital of Cook County, Illinois, where she volunteers as an attending internist. Dr. Rogers is assistant professor of medicine at Rush University. Dr. Eric Reinhardt is an anthropologist of policing, prisons, and public health, and a psychiatry resident at the Physician Scientist Training Program at Northwestern University's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Medicaid, given what's happening right now. In the coming year, as many as 15 million low-income people could lose their Medicaid coverage. Before the COVID pandemic, people had to re-enroll for Medicaid every year by proving they were eligible. That was suspended during the pandemic. So starting this month, Medicaid recipients have to re-enroll again. And advocates say that they're very concerned about procedural errors. They're concerned that people do not know about this. Some states are starting to kick people off the rolls already. Other states are going to take a year to determine who qualifies. Dr. Rogers, I think it's important to note that to qualify for Medicaid across the country, these are general, it depends on where you live, but overall, as one person, you have to make less than $20,000. For a family of four, less than $40,000. So we're talking about people who are really struggling to make ends meet here. How concerned are you about this?
Very concerned. And I, along with PNHP, have been concerned way before COVID. I mean, Medicaid was always underfunded, as Medicare was. The reimbursement rate pays less than what other reimbursements rates were through private insurance. So what that message sends is these patients aren't valued as much. And that has carried over into the lack of care that these patients on Medicaid receive. Even though it is federally funded and state administered, each state has its own criteria of what gets covered, how much the reimbursement is, what the criteria are for you to be able to receive Medicaid. So a lot of these states, especially in the South, I think chose not to accept Medicaid expansion, again, because of racism. A lot of the majority of Black people who live in this country, adults, the majority live in the southern states that did not expand Medicaid. But even when you look in the north, the disparate reimbursements, the lack of coverage, the fact that they are restricted to narrow networks means that they cannot really access care. I know working at Cook County, when I started at Cook County, there was no privatization of Medicaid. And then as the years went on, it became more and more difficult for Medicaid patients to come there and receive their care because they were restricted to a network that often didn't necessarily have the services that they needed. So what we have to do is we have to expand the services and the reimbursement that Medicaid provides so that we can not just show that these patients have value, but that we can provide the care that they need. And I know that even at Cook County, we couldn't even do joint transplants if you needed a hip replacement because the hardware was too expensive. We couldn't afford it despite the patients needing that. So underlying the whole decision about who gets care and how it's covered is still poisoned by this whole concern for profit. And that if you're in something for profit, poor people are not the people that you want to take care of because you will not make the profit with that patient population. And so we have to take totally the profit out of healthcare, and that would be with a single payer system.
Up to 3 million people could lose their Medicaid or Medi-Cal here in California. So be sure to just ensure that you get the information that you need in the mail or make the phone call. You have to fill out this paperwork. And community groups are trying to get the word out. But again, we're talking about funding here. Dr. Reinhardt, It also says so much about this society where you've got a total of 90 million people on Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program. And again, to qualify, less than $20,000 for one person or $40,000 for a family of four, and 90 million people qualify for this. It just speaks to the suffering that's going on out there. And to think that 15 million of those people could lose their coverage soon.
Yeah. It's obviously wrong. I think if you value human life, there's something absolutely ethically objectionable to this. It's also flatly stupid from a population level perspective, from an economic perspective. If you're wealthy and you're not touched by this directly, you might think it doesn't matter. But in fact, it returns to you and has massive economic costs for the entire country. And we don't provide people proper care. There's a very strong relationship between healthcare access, for example, and violence rates and public safety and workforce participation. So even if you don't care personally about poor people getting care in this country, you should care about the consequences that it brings back to the entire economy, to our safety infrastructure, and to our governmental system. So what we have is a frankly sadistic policy. It's cruelty for the sake of it. And I don't think people realize that often, but that is structurally what is operative. And it's important to note that in addition to all these people who are on Medicaid and often cannot access the care they need because we do not fund Medicaid properly in this country and reimbursement rates are so low, there are also over 30 million people that have no insurance at all. And they are excluded. And to echo what Dr. Rogers was saying, even prior to the pandemic, this was a massive problem. There was a study published in Lancet that estimated 68,000 people in the U.S. died every single year before COVID simply because they could not afford the cost of healthcare. That is a lot of deaths in service of profit. During the pandemic, there was a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, one of the top science journals in the world, that estimated 338,000 U.S. lives could have been saved in the first 2 years of the pandemic alone if we had had universal healthcare like every other industrialized nation in the world. So this system is obscenely violent. We're manufacturing deaths by the thousands every single week. And it's not just the explicitly for-profit actors in it, like the pharmaceutical companies and for-profit healthcare chains. It's also our academic medical centers. Our nonprofits are caught up in this. The profit incentive doesn't require that you label yourself a for-profit company. I trained at the University of Chicago for some years ago. In around 2005, Jim Madera, who became, after he left the University of Chicago, the CEO of the American Medical Association, where he remains right now, he wrote a paper back then that was published that argued that academic medical centers like the University of Chicago, with lots of money, lots of specialized resources, that their responsibility was not, in fact, to provide care or respond to the needs of the communities around them. They had such specialized knowledge that they should reserve it for the most complex medical cases and just put off basic community care, responsiveness to one's surrounding neighborhoods, to other hospitals. Now, what we've seen over time is that academic medical centers around the country have taken this stance, really renounced a responsibility to care for the communities around them, often poor, racialized communities like at Yale, at Hopkins, at University of Chicago, at many places in the Bay Area as well, and throughout California. And now what you see is that I've been working on some research with colleagues of mine in California, actually, that shows that the biggest contributors to medical segregation are not actually the for-profit hospitals. They're the nonprofit academic medical centers. So we need to think about the problem that profit produces within our healthcare systems beyond simply the explicitly for-profit entities. This pervades the entirety of the system. And you can't have patchwork reforms. We need fundamental transformation of the basis of our healthcare system in the U.S.
Where can we find more information about that? We'd love to do a show about that.
About the medical segregation in California?
Yes. Well, the nonprofit hospitals you're talking about, because you're right. We tend to focus on the companies that are making the money, so much money, and the billions, like the United Health Group making $20 billion last year, Cigna making almost $7 billion last year.
Right.
But we don't hear about these nonprofit hospitals as much.
You should talk to my colleague. His name is Joe Friedman. He's at UCLA. He's one of the individuals with whom I've been doing this research. And I think the group would love to do a show with you. So I agree. It's an important issue and not recognized widely enough.
Right. Well,
can I add a comment
please.
To that?
Please. Yes.
Yeah. One of the things, the only difference between a nonprofit hospital and a for-profit hospital is whether they have shareholders and pay taxes. Their philosophy is exactly the same when it comes to making money. And they don't provide property taxes. So the surrounding community around a nonprofit hospital, what happens to the schools when they don't pay property taxes? So there's a direct impact on their neighborhoods. And just because they're for not for profit, they are not altruistic or they are not forgiving. And one of the things too, I lost my train of thought here, but one of the things also about with Medicaid is that the hoops and what people have to go through to get their Medicaid, make sure that they have Medicaid is like a obstacle course. And patients who are eligible to receive Medicaid often have the fewest resources to navigate that system. Right. They often may not have computers. They may not have phones. They may not have transportation. They may have young children at home. So this makes it even more difficult for them to be able to access the care that they may be able to receive, because it's just made to be such a phenomenally difficult journey to get. Mm. And that's, well, I think, is done on purpose.
And we should say that North Carolina Republicans finally agreed to expand Medicaid coverage. It took them 13 years, and it's going to cover 600,000 people, but 600,000 people in North Carolina will still be without insurance because they're just above those financial levels. But we still have 10 Republican-controlled states that have refused to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, and The New Yorker actually had such a devastating article about how people in Mississippi, for example, have a preventable cancer. It's on the rise because they do not have access to health care. I really encourage you to read this. It's just such a devastating, important article. To your point, Dr. Rogers, we have an email from Wendy who says, the policy enacted to help seniors access Medicare has now been so changed with both Medicare Advantage plans and direct contracting. They've become so convoluted, they do not serve seniors well. The benefit of Medicare is that all seniors were on the same plan, and what it covered and what it didn't were largely known. Now, with all the different privatized, quote, Advantage plans, it takes a genius to figure it out, and you may have to change your doctors. None of this is easy to do as a senior, especially an older senior, without an adult child or an advocate to help them.
I can tell you, I hate to date myself, but my husband and I, we both turned 65 the same year. He's a physician too. And we both had to ask for help. It's a ridiculous system. It's phenomenally complicated. And then you've got Joe Namath on the TV trying to convince you to go into Medicare Advantage. It is just awful. I don't even know the right word. It is just an awful system to navigate. And again, when you ask somebody to help you, if you get an agent, they get a bonus for what you end up buying. So they're not even steering you to what's best for you. They're steering you to how they can get the best bonus out of getting you into a certain Medicare plan. So it's phenomenally complicated, much more than it needs to be. And that's what makes single payer so simple. Everybody has the exact same benefits. Everybody can go to whatever doctor they want, whatever hospital they want. And it's just simple. There's no question about whether you can or whether you can't go here or get this. And we need to get the complexity out of all of healthcare. Even if you have a private insurance plan from your employer, it's still complicated to figure out what your actual benefits are. And it's made to be like that. It's made to be in the advantage of the profit-making entity in this equation.
Wendy, I know that this is an issue that a lot of listeners bring up, so we'll definitely do an entire show about that. Thank you for the email. Gary has a question about single payer. Gary writes, can you address what to me looks like the 800-pound gorilla? What happens to the jobs lost when single payer is adopted? How does the insurance industry get, quote, bailed out once they've lost their profits? What kind of transitions are we talking about here? Dr. Rogers, do you want to take that first?
Sure. Well, I know when Representative Conyers first put his bill out several years ago, within that bill, he had a plan to retrain healthcare workers into other jobs and with responsibilities within the healthcare system. And we will maybe need more people within healthcare because we will be able to expand services and people may have more needs. It will cost us less. That's the other thing that people are afraid of. But so much of the money is going to private insurance companies. Physicians spend so much more time on administrative work and spending time talking to insurance companies to convince them to provide care to their patients that they would actually be able to see more patients. So we wouldn't overwhelm the system. We wouldn't be spending more money just by taking care of more people, because these are people who may have presented late in the course of their disease and end up costing more money anyway. So there's plenty of money to be able to take care of all patients who need it here. But because it would be a more efficient system, if you look at traditional Medicare, which is a fee-for-service system, you see a patient, the provider sends the bill to CMS. CMS sends the money back to the provider. The process is over. And it's very simple. The overhead for traditional Medicare is maybe 2% at the most. For Medicare Advantage, it's over 25%. And now with the new ACO REACH and all of that, we're approaching 40% profit for these for-profit entities, insurance companies. So we would save so much more money, and the people who are currently working within the healthcare system can find other jobs. There will be maybe increased need for care in some hospitals and some institutions. Right now, we have medical deserts where there's no hospital, nobody working there. There are places where people can find work who have skills in the healthcare system. So there is a way to take care of the people who are working there who wouldn't be working after that. And there's a way that it will take care of people whose needs have not been met because they could not afford it or were living in areas where it was a medical desert. So this can be done. Other countries do it. We spend twice as much money as other countries, yet we have the worst outcomes. So there's no, it's illogical to think we should continue with the system we have when we have examples of systems who work within a single payer system, who spend less money, whose people are healthier.
We have a few callers on the line, so let's take a few and then we'll get final thoughts from our guests. Let's go to Karen in Oakland. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I just want to make one comment before I make my comment, and this is to give a suggestion to Dr. Rogers, who couldn't think of a term to apply to Medicare Advantage, and that term is scam. They are scamming organizations.
Yes.
So here's what I want to say, that not only are we having problems with Medicare and the health insurance industries, but we also have problems with hedge funds buying out specialty medical practice like in the Bay Area. We now have Golden State Dermatology, Golden State Orthopedics, and these hedge funds are also buying out skilled nursing facilities, rehab centers, nursing homes, et cetera, around the country. So you can find the same name of a nursing home, like there's one called City View in Berkeley, or San Francisco, rather, and they're all over the place. And this is one of the biggest scams, is having hedge funds buy into the healthcare companies, because they also let go of professional staff, so there are fewer nurses, fewer professionals working there. So the treatment is horrible. That's what I have to say.
Well, thank you for that, Karen. That is another show we should do. We did a piece about a CalMatters investigation about nursing homes, so thank you for that. A couple other callers, we don't have time to take them, but Greg wants to say healthcare is a business. We're going to have to change our views so we see it as a system. He also says the country is incredibly violent and was founded that way. Mary says we should learn from other countries where they have more integrated health systems and use alternatives. Here in the U.S., we use too many pharmaceuticals. A lot of emails coming in. We'll have to have you both back to continue this conversation. But Dr. Reinhart, we talked about a lot today. Final thoughts. What can people do? We're getting a couple emails saying we couldn't even get universal health care here in California.
We have to organize. And we're going to have to organize outside of healthcare. There are too many entrenched perverse interests inside of the healthcare system. Doctors are complicit with this. Healthcare administrators are complicit with this, et cetera. I think it's going to be very hard to generate the political momentum that we need from inside the healthcare industry. What we progressive actors have to do who are inside is collaborate with people outside. What we've just seen in Chicago might be a model, for example. In the mayoral election, you had a really strong union movement that delivered an election result a lot of people did not expect to see come to fruition. There are a lot of things stacked against it. I think the most important thing we can do is begin to organize as intensely as possible to demand massive changes, because we don't just need single payer. We need to change who it is we are paying and what it is we are paying for. So there's a piece in The Nation by Adam Gaffney and Steffi Woolhandler and some others. It was called Why Medicare for All is Not Enough. I think this is a really important piece that shows how the financialized structure of U.S. healthcare right now makes it such that Medicare for All is important, but it is only a stepping stone to where we need to go. And to get there, we can't rely upon the people who benefit from the status quo. We are going to have to organize as a collective well beyond the healthcare industry.
Dr. Rogers, final thoughts? We have about 30 seconds.
Okay, yeah. The status of our healthcare is really a reflection of our society. It mirrors the whole dysfunction in so many other areas of our society. But I think healthcare, we look at as a right. We have a right to be healthy. We have a right to healthcare when we need it. And one of the things that I'm really concerned about is as physicians become employees and are told what to do and what they can't do, and they have to do this for or whatever, their medical decisions are taken away from them. When I trained, I loved being a clinician because the decisions were made between me and the patient. That is getting lost, and we don't want a country full of unhappy doctors and dissatisfied patients, which is where we're headed unless we can fix this for-profit motive within the system.
Dr. Susan Rogers is president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Eric Reinhardt is psychiatry resident at Northwestern University's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. Thank you both for joining us, and we'd love to have you back to continue this conversation.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I hope you can join us tomorrow. It's somewhat related to today's show. Journalist Alyssa Court will discuss her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.